everyone. My name is Jose Domingo Cruz, and welcome back to the Gender Fluency audio recordings. In the summer of 2017, I talked with Robert Long about fluency, gender, and working as instructors in Japanese university English classes. This time, Professor Long and I talked about issues in disfluency. Let's listen to that.
Good morning, Jose.
Good morning, Bob.
So today I would like to talk about disfluency, like what to be aware of in our own speech and with our own students, and how to address it in the classroom.
That would be fun.
So in terms of our experiences, this is something we've been aware of with Japanese. They have certain problems, certain issues.
Right.
In a language teacher article that I wrote, I found that the biggest problems that students seem to have was that of just production, getting them to talk long enough.
Mm-hmm.
Students were a bit too shy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then followed by this was pauses and silence. Sometimes the pauses were too frequent, mm-hmm. or sometimes too long.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the third problem was a relatively slow speaking rate. So Japanese tend to think long and carefully about what they're going to say, and they want to make sure it's grammatically correct. And so the speaking rate is about half of what a native speaker would have.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts about this? Did you find any other disfluency issues that were important in your own experiences?
I think those are probably, if not the top three, certainly in the top five. Mm. I just go back to the last point that you made about their tendency to be over-drilled under grammatical accuracy and how their prior education makes them think that that's the be-all and end-all of becoming better at English. I think first, if you're going to be addressing fluency, you have to make it clear to the students, to the audience that you're speaking to, that you are there to teach them something that, number one, they've probably never been taught very much before.
Mm.
That in their prior classes, in you know, especially junior high school, that everything that they've studied about English, whatever they think in the back of their heads, this isn't really good for my English, or I'm not really learning a lot of English, is true. And you end up having to be very careful not to disrespect too much of what it is that they've studied to the point where you're making them think, oh my God, I've wasted all my time. I'm never going to learn how to speak English.
Mm.
You tell them that fluency is a very separate thing. But what you've learned up to this point with your grammar is something that's still useful. It's just that I want you, as a teacher, you're saying, I want you to not think about that as what we're doing.
Mm.
So if you're going to be teaching about fluency, you have to tell the students, you have to get their, not just their consent, but their realization, their awareness that fluency is a very different skill. And I use lots of analogies, and one of the biggest analogies that I use is sports. Grammar accuracy and vocabulary acquisition are important things, but fluency itself is a completely different skill. So first you, I think, begin by telling the students we're going to address a different skill, one that you probably haven't addressed before, and then you go on from there.
Mm. It's hard to get them to kind of value the importance of fluency. Just because they're able to be grammatically correct doesn't mean that they're going to be persuasive, they're going to be informative enough to be able to make a point.
Right, right.
And without being able to make a point and to influence decisions, they're not going to be really valued as much as someone that is perhaps less grammatically correct and but just more fluent.
And I think, you know, because we're both from countries that have a lot of immigration. I'm from Canada, you're America. We have in our experience a lot of times that we can look back and say, yeah, you know, when I talked to that Pakistani guy, when I talked to that guy from Haiti, yeah, he made a lot of grammatical mistakes, but wow, he was a really a forceful thinker.
Mm.
He really made me think. We have a lot of experiences, because we come from immigrant countries, with people who get their point across, even though they're grammatically, they could just say, incorrect.
Mm.
Now, with a lot of these kids, that's not their experience.
Mm.
You're either correct in Japanese or with a lot of their ALTs or a lot of their JETs, because for some people from America or Canada, they have this self-imposed cage that they put themselves in where they say, oh, I refuse to speak Japanese with my students.
Mm.
Or they can't because they don't know the language. So they don't hear a lot of other people making a lot of mistakes in Japanese but still being very forceful. On the flip side, they don't hear a lot of their own mistakes because a lot of them only do English in the classroom and they don't hear teachers and they don't hear themselves using English to communicate, making mistakes, but still getting their point across. We have this background in our own experiences where we see a lot of that. We see that it does work with a lot of these kids, especially junior high school kids. To them, language is just something that either you know or you don't know. And I think that also is something that has to be addressed in the classroom. You have to provide so many things that we take for granted in our experiences that help us see that fluency is a very different thing from grammar with these kids. They don't have that background.
Well, I think even with educators and with the students as well, so they don't really know the gap between, say, native speakers and where they're at. For with speaking rates, as I said, I mean, the native speakers speak twice as fast. In terms of crosstalk pausing, native speakers almost had zero.
So just quickly, Bob, for the audience, can you just describe what crosstalk pausing is?
Crosstalk pausing is the pausing between the two speakers.
So like when neither of them are speaking.
Right. Okay. Right. So, and then word fragments or mispronounced words, again, it's night and day. Zero for native speakers. Abandoned sentences.
One more time. Zero mistakes in what category for native?
Mispronounced words.
Really?
Right.
Okay, I was thinking that I should probably take that mistake that I made earlier because it made me sound stupid. I wanted to say, wow. In the middle of this conversation, and I said, bow.
Okay.
Now, how would that be counted in your research as a mispronunciation mistake by me? I said, bow. I didn't say, wow. Was that a mispronunciation?
That would be categorized as mispronunciation.
He says, so I don't know about this zero mispronunciation.
Well, with the data that I had.
Okay. Because I think I hear, when you become a transcriber of conversations, like I have to be for my website, you hear mispronunciation mistakes and are very aware of them because you have to write that down. And I have this rule that says I will write down exactly what was said to show how many times native speakers use pause words, how many times even we can crosstalk, how many mistakes we make in grammar. And it becomes very, very clear. So I don't know about that zero mistake statistic. Sorry to, disagree with you at this point, but I'm not sure about that one.
Well, I mean, in terms of native speakers knowing the pronunciation of most of what the words they're going to say.
So not knowing the pronunciation of a word as opposed to just a simple mispronunciation.
If it's a simple, slight mispronunciation, but I can understand what the word means, it's a big no problem.
Okay.
So even with Japanese mispronouncing and as ando, I really didn't count that because this would throw this particular category off the realm.
Right.
So I mean, if it was a word that I just could not understand what he or she said, then I counted that as a mispronunciation.
That's a mispronunciation.
Right.
That's interesting. Okay. So it wasn't because of accents or anything like that.
No. And then just repetition. About half of what the native speakers were doing. The native speakers had half of the errors.
But they still repeated, right? Even native speakers.
Still repeated, yeah.
Right.
Not as much as before. But right. One of the interesting things was the average mean length runs. And this is how long you can talk before pausing.
Right.
And so this was interesting. The native speakers would talk 102 syllables compared to 9 syllables for the Japanese language learners.
And that means that they were able to speak maybe about 2 or 3 sentences until they had to
pause
just simply stop.
Right.
Right. Yeah, sure. And I think a lot of that, that's where your statistics help back up my idea that this has to be taught as a skill, not as knowledge. Kids can probably do that, but like a lot of the or eventually could do that if they were given the chance to practice. But a lot of their responses in class, we say that you call it a bipolar response, but it's only a yes or a no. But that's because that's all the teacher expects.
Right.
Psychologically, subconsciously, that's all they expect from the students. The students know that if they just keep the responses down to a certain level, then they don't have to say much more. It's a psychology of the classroom, and that's all they do. So if you can address that, at the same time without making them too conscious of what's being happening in terms of their listen to me and they're going to hear my English. If you can remove all of that from the equation, then they are going to start speaking a lot more. And eventually that skill can be practiced.
Right. The most difficult thing is getting the students to become aware of having the teacher give feedback so that they actually understand how much they need to progress or where they're actually at.
That's where I think my teaching style is still lacking, and I want to figure out how to address more things like feedback, because my original style of teaching was actually designed to be taught by three teachers to about 20 students at a time. And one teacher is the lead teacher. Another teacher does the demonstrations with the lead teacher. And there's a third teacher that's always monitoring or sitting in with the other students. Now, because I'm only one teacher in a classroom, sometimes at 45, sometimes at up to 50 students, I had to reconfigure everything so that I was the only teacher in the classroom. And I can't really monitor these kids. I can't really provide the feedback that really could be much more useful.
It's hard. It's a hard challenge. Okay, well, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Bob.